Hello and welcome to another episode of the Wednesday Conversation. I'm Mike Kresnick, and I'm here with Pastor Bob Thune and Pastor Dusty Wyatt of Corumdale Church and Pastor Chris Hemmelman of First City Church. Every Wednesday, we sit down and talk about how the gospel of Jesus Christ connects to the questions and issues of everyday life. And today, we're talking about third world problems.
Third world problems. Not what you think. Not what you think. We're going to get to this in a minute. But first, hey, let's celebrate the end of 2020.
Yeah.
Right? We did it. Can we get some of that?
We made it.
Yes. Get some cheering.
Almost. I guess there's one more day technically, but
hold on tight.
We're almost there, y'all. We're almost there. It's been a year. However, one good thing about 2020 is the release of Carl Truman's book, The Rise and Triumph of the Modern Self, which is what this episode of the podcast will be based on. I think we'll likely be talking about this book for many other episodes as well. I think it's one of the most important books written in the last few years. I think it's incredibly helpful. And in this particular episode, we want to talk about chapter 2 of this book and a concept that Carl Truman introduces us to that is fascinating and helpful and helps us make a little bit of sense of our cultural moment. So I want to try to set up the overall sort of framework of the entire book, and then we're going to hone in on this topic that Mike just mentioned. So let me give you a big picture overview. And I really do think, there's a lot of books that are interesting to me and not necessarily to other people, but this is one of those books that if you are a Christian leader, this needs to be a priority for you to read your way through, read it slowly, read it thoughtfully, understand the connections Carl Truman is making, because I think this book is very, very helpful for what it looks like to do Christian mission in the modern cultural context. What Truman is trying to understand is, or he's trying to help us understand, is how did we get to a place where let me read you the first sentence of the book. I think it will help you understand what he's trying to do. Quote, "The origins of this book lie in my curiosity about how and why a particular statement has come to be regarded as coherent and meaningful. I am a woman trapped in a man's body. My grandfather died in 1994, less than 30 years ago, and yet had he ever heard that sentence uttered in his presence, I have little doubt that he would have burst out laughing and consider it a piece of incoherent gibberish. And yet today it is a sense that many in our society regard as not only meaningful, but so significant that to deny it or question it in some way is to reveal oneself as stupid, immoral, or subject to yet another irrational phobia." That's the intro of the book. He's saying, I want to talk about how we got to the place in the world where you could say, I'm a woman trapped in a man's body, and that can make sense and sound coherent to people. And so to get there, he's basically going to chronicle for us some key shifts in his thesis is the key shift over the last 200 years is in how people understand the self. So this statement, I'm a woman trapped in a man's body, has less to do with sexuality and a lot more to do with how we've come to understand what it means to be a self. And so what Carl Truman is doing is he's a historian. So he's doing this historical and philosophical work for us to say, let me trace out for you the trajectory of what changed in how modern people think about the self that got us to the place where the self is now this very fluid category that sort of can be redefined and whatever. So that's the journey he wants to take us on. Now, the whole book is that journey, and it's a very thought-provoking book, and I think a very, he makes a compelling case for the fact that shifts in our understanding of the self are what lies underneath the sexual revolution. But in chapter 2, he spends the first two chapters saying, hey, let me give you some tools you're going to need to go on this journey with me. So let me lay out some concepts that if you grasp these, then we'll do some historical work together. And so he wants to introduce us to especially a sociologist from the University of Pennsylvania named Philip Reif. And Philip Reif has this taxonomy. He said, Carl Truman says that Philip Reif wrote in 1966, but when you read now what he wrote in 1966, it seems freaky. It's one of those books you look back and you're like, this guy was seeing some things that I don't know anyone would have seen coming. And so what he says is the modern West is a third world culture. And this is Philip Reif's taxonomy, is first world, second world, third world. Now, We're not talking economic development. We're not talking, you know, modern restrooms and running water and those kinds of things. We're talking, Philip Reeve is using these categories in an entirely different way. So here's the quick sort of chart summary of what these things mean. First worlds are worlds that appeal to myth. So think about like the Greek and Roman mythology. They make sense of the moral order by appealing to myth, the gods, this sort of structure for the world based in mythology. Second worlds are characterized not by fate or myth, but by faith. So second world is Christianity and probably also to a lesser degree Islam. Worldviews where there's a religious order that provides that transcendence. Third worlds are cultures that lack any transcendent reference point outside themselves. So what Philip Reeve is suggesting is that the order of civilization is you had these first worlds, you had Greek and Roman culture where they grounded ethics and morality by appealing to myth and fate. Then you had Christianity and Christendom, which grounded morality and ethics by appealing to God and God's law. Now we live in a third world, and the third world has no transcendent reference point. There's no way to ground ethics in anything outside or beyond or above us. And so Reeve says they lack any justification beyond themselves. This is very similar to what Charles Taylor means when he talks about the immanent frame, the idea that there's no transcendent reference point anymore. But so what Philip Reeve says is in third worlds, there's no way of adjudicating or sorting out ethical dilemmas. All right, so first world, second world, third world, fate, faith, self. Okay? Here's an example. Carl Truman, page 78. Let's take a specific example, abortion. A prohibition on abortion depends on the notion of personhood. Is an embryo a person with potential, or is it a potential person? You can see how in a first world or a second world, the way you resolve that question is to appeal to some sort of transcendent reference point. So you might say, for instance, in a Christian worldview, hey, a person is made in the image of God, and therefore, because this is a person made in the image of God, this life has dignity, value, and worth, and that maps onto then how we conceive of the ethics of something like abortion. He says, once one removes the sacred order, however, to say that an embryo is a person becomes an arbitrary claim when the things we typically associate with personhood through our experience of it, things like independent existence, the capacity for self-reflection, the ability to act with intention toward the future, and so on, are apparently absent. What a person is or is not is, in a third world, now a matter for debate. Now, if personhood has become a contested matter on which there is no agreement, other criteria for determining the legitimacy of abortion come into play. In a therapeutic culture, these tend to resolve themselves into the simple question of whether giving birth to a child will be conducive to the mother's well-being, itself a highly subjective concept for which no real objective criteria can be supplied. So you'll notice he's using abortion as a moral example, and he's saying in a first world or a second world where there's some kind of transcendent understanding of morality, there's at least something you can appeal to that provides a stable point for having these debates. But when you start living in a world where there's no appeal to any transcendent beyond, now all we have are just sort of assertions of preference. What's really fascinating then is Philip Reeve is making the case that we in the modern West are living in a third world. We're living in a world where there's no longer accepted any transcendent reference point. Now, many of us who are professing Christians still live in a second world. Like he's like, hey, actually what you have is first world, second world, and third world all colliding together, right? So you have all of these paradigms are present, but the overall reigning paradigm in our culture is a third world paradigm. No one believes that there actually is any, there's not a consensus that there is a transcendent moral order for us to appeal to. And that's why we're stuck in this world where everything seems to be about who has power and therefore gets to just instantiate their vision of morality by saying it is so. That's why I think you see so much emphasis on politics right now, because it's kind of the way you decide who's right and who's wrong is, well, who has the power and gets to make the rules. That's kind of the answer right now. There are two fascinating features of third worlds that Philip Reeve builds out. Number one, third worlds are anti-historical. They reject the past as worthy of respect because, after all, the past is, you know, we've moved beyond that. We don't believe in fairies and gods and sprites and demons and superstition anymore. And so there's just no value for the past and for history. And so Philip Reeve says third worlds tend to be anti-historical. That's why you see a profound movement in our society erasing or not caring much about history and saying, hey, let's just focus on the here and now. It's why humanities are less and less an emphasis in schools. It's why history departments are less and less about, you know, ancient history and European history and American history, and a lot more about like the histories of little sub interest groups. Right. And
doesn't he also mention something like that's why you see a movement of tearing down statues, yeah, and all of that stuff.
Yes. Because they're anti-historical. And second, he says third worlds are actually anti-cultures. So this is really fascinating. He says a culture is defined by passing something on. Like what makes culture is there's some kind of heritage or deposit that we want to pass on to our kids and grandkids or to the people who come behind us in society. And once you don't have any transcendent order anymore, you have really nothing to pass on. And so third worlds are anti-cultures. They're not so much interested in passing anything on as in just sort of tearing stuff down and deconstructing things. So what's interesting is I think he's naming why we see so much emphasis right now on deconstruction, on tearing down, on eradicating, on doing away with, and this really intense energy in that direction. Like, it's interesting to me that you don't see a whole lot of people saying, hey, let's have some conversations about where we got things wrong in the past, right? It's sort of like, hey, because that whoever that guy's statue is was a slaveholder, let's tear down the statue and get rid of it and erase it from memory. Now, again, you can agree or disagree with sort of the statue side of things, but it's an example of what Philip Reeve is talking about, of this movement towards sort of eradicating both history and culture.
I really appreciated his definition of culture, because it seems like everybody else's definition of culture doesn't really pull the history string or the pass down from generation to generation. So when I read that, I was like, oh, that's interesting. I haven't thought about that. I've just thought about as groups of people, whatever their normal practices are, kind of create culture.
Let me read his definition, top of page 89. Culture is the name given to those traditions, institutions, and patterns of behavior that transmit the values of one generation to the next.
Yeah, so another way to say this is first, second world see life largely as something, or existence as something we receive. It's a given, where third world, it's all self-defined. Mm-hmm. And that's a massive difference in how you view life and how you even construct your identity and understand ethics and meaning and purpose. Is there something larger than me that I am in many ways submitted to, and I receive this and it's kind of a trust? Or is life just however I want to define myself, define meaning, purpose, ethics? And I think the other thing as I was reading this chapter, and just the descriptions, is how, like, I think of like maybe 15, 20 years ago in college, coming out of college, the whole postmodern movement. And you hear kind of how postmodernism like undermined like meta narratives and all this. But it's fascinating that when they talked about postmodernism, it was so at such like maybe the level of ideas and intellect that it didn't necessarily always, some guys, like even these guys that are writing, you know, Reeve is writing in the 60s, but the sort of deconstructive, like the destructive aspect of this, not just I'm trying to recreate culture. No, this is just like, it's eating itself. Yeah. And we're seeing that, like that the ethos of the third world is really is destruction. Like, what is the end? What is the utopia? You don't even necessarily hear like this beautiful vision other than just a bunch of people self-defining, fighting, grabbing for power. Like, at least back in the day, there was some sense of trying to create this ideal world. Maybe that's buried in what we're seeing today, but it seems just like the energy is just such a destructive energy right now that, postmodern is just basically eating itself. And that's what's really this part is fascinating, that I don't remember reading quite that negative energy back, 20 years ago.
Well, and that's why I think what Truman is doing here is fascinating, because he's naming something that I think I've kind of intuitively sensed, but not had language for. Mm-hmm. You sense that, and Truman, by the way, is very very clear eyed about this. He's like, hey, I'm not into nostalgia. I'm not looking to go back to the 1950s. Just so you guys know, I'm not into like, let's create Leave It to Beaver. But I do want to be honest about the fact that in third world, like once you abandon any kind of transcendent moral order, it really does become a deconstructive project. And that's where we are in Western culture right now. Mm-hmm. And so nobody's building anything. We're just tearing things mm-hmm. down. And he says the concern is no culture can long survive if it does that. Mm-hmm. So what's interesting is I've been rethinking the whole idea of culture war, because I think I was, in traditional evangelicalism back in the 80s, that was kind of, everything was about kind of like, it was just kind of a culture war moment, then I kind of reacted against that in church planting and was like, hey, like that, the culture war narrative is a played out narrative and it doesn't actually help us make disciples. And I think there's truth that it was overly simplistic, but what I'm realizing, what Truman highlights is, but there is a sense in which we have to resist the tearing down of mm-hmm. and the dismantling of history and culture. And so as we talk about, the nature of this podcast, how does the gospel speak to these things? Where we're going to get to is, hey, it's actually going to be really, really crucial in the coming decades for the church to have a defined culture, for the church to be a place where there is a set of values, traditions that we're passing on, that we are actually building something and creating something and passing on to those behind us something meaningful, because we're increasingly living in a world where that's just not the case. Actually, everything around us is being deconstructed. So the idea of the anti-culture, Philip Reef naming that, is fascinating, because it did put words on something for me. Like, that's kind of what it feels like. Mm-hmm. It feels like there's not really an interest to just critique or challenge or say, hey, is that a good piece of our heritage that we should be handing down, or should we maybe rethink that? Mm-hmm. It's sort of just like, let's tear it all down. Let's burn it all down.
Yeah.
Does he, right now on my bedside is the Douglas Murray book, Madness of Crowds.
Yep.
And, what comes to mind, obviously, is like the Dreher book, The Benedict Option. You've read the whole thing. I haven't. I've just read this much, right? So like, does he get to, hey, if you're in the second world, living in the third world, this is what we should do? Or does he just kind of say like, here's the facts, boys and girls?
His last chapter is really fascinating, because he says, hey, here's what I think we need to do. But he says it as a historian. So he's like, hey, look, I don't know where history is going, nor am I trying to prescribe what the church should do. But here's some interesting observations I'd want to make about the trends I'm noticing. So I think Truman, again, is very measured and wise. He doesn't seem to be overly prescriptive, and he's way different than Rod Dreher. Dreher's like, we all need him. The Benedict Option is the
like,
answer. This is the answer. Hashtag Benedict Option, TM. Truman seems to be saying, hey, this is where things are. I think I have a sense of what the church needs to give itself to, but it's much more big picture and general, less prescriptive, I would say.
Does he say that the third world is going to implode on itself?
Yeah, he basically says that it can't sustain itself for long. Yeah. So something's going to have to give.
Sure.
Who knows what that will be. But yeah, we can't, he basically says, and it's very fascinating, because the key thinkers he profiles are Rousseau, Freud, Marx, and then the new Marxist, the new left. And so he says, hey, there's a trajectory that started with Rousseau that goes through Freud and Marx. And he says, this is So I don't want to get ahead of this podcast because this is just focused on this one chapter, but he says, here's the revolutions that had to happen. The self had to get psychologized. Psychology had to get sexualized. Mm. And then sex had to get politicized.
Oh man.
So that's, those are the three shifts. Is in Rousseau, the self became psychologized. In Freud, psychology became sexualized. And in the Marxists, sex became politicized. And he just says that's how we got to the transgender revolution, is if you have a view of the self that is psychological, sexual, and political, you lay all those things on top of each other, and that's how we got to where we are. So, but he's saying in that whole trajectory, we also end up in this place where we're in this third world where there's no transcendent appeal to the image of God or to the existence of God or to the law of God or to any myth or transcendent value beyond the here and now. And because that's the case, the only thing that matters to people is subjective preference. The only moral imperative is my well-being, my psychological and personal well-being. And when that's the only moral imperative, then you can't ever have a meaningful dialogue about, you know, what ought or should be. It's entirely individualized. And so that's the fascinating observation here. But this idea of third worlds is interesting to me because I think it does lay something over. You know, we've talked about the immanent frame. We had Jamie Smith on this podcast and had him lay out his thinking about Charles Taylor and some of the, you know, life in a secular age. Philip Reif lays very cleanly kind of on top of that, naming these same things, which is that we live in a moment in history where there is no sense that there's anything beyond us. And that really does affect how our moral reasoning operates. Now, here's the one other observation Philip Reif makes that I think is an interesting phrase that we need to drop into the equation. It's the idea of death works. When Philip Reif speaks of death works, this is a quote from him. He means an all-out assault upon something vital to the established culture. Every death work represents an admiring final assault on the objects of its admiration, the sacred orders of which their arts are some expression. So he says this usually takes place in art, but death works is a movement in art and aesthetics that's intended to make the old values look ridiculous. The example that he uses is this piece of art many of you will be familiar with called Piss Christ. This came out probably in the late 1990s, where this artist took a crucifix and submerged it in a jar of urine. And this was his piece of art. And it made all kinds of religious people angry for good reason. But the point was, it's an example of this kind of death works, where it's taking something that's very sacred and hallowed to a second world moral order, and it's trying to sort of desecrate it and make it look vile and ridiculous. He says that's a really stark example, but here's some other examples of what Philip Reif would consider, or what Carl Truman says would count as death works. Think about the way we use cynicism and irony. Think about mockery as part of our humor. Think about pornography.
Yeah, can you summarize what he says about the pornography piece?
So what he says is, of course, there's been this tradition in the history of art that of the body. Think about, you know, Leonardo da Vinci's drawing representation of a human being. Think about all the nude art of the Renaissance, the famous Renaissance painters who painted bodies. He says pornography is a way of taking all of that, which was a way of reflecting beautifully and artistically upon the human form. And what pornography does is to basically destroy all of that, because it takes the human form and makes it an object of lust and of desire. And he says pornography is not, the problem with pornography isn't just that it promotes lust and the objectification of people. He says the problem is pornography repudiates any notion that sex has significance beyond the act itself. And therefore it rejects any notion that it is emblematic of a sacred order. That's the key. So what he says is, for most of human history, everybody has understood that sex has a sacredness to it. And what pornography does is just destroy the sacredness of any of that and imply that sexuality has no connection to anything sacred and beyond. And that, therefore, it's a death work in the language of Philip Brief.
So therefore, we're in the third world. And if you hold to sexual activity as sacred or significant beyond just sex being the end in itself, then you must be living in the second world.
Right. Yeah. Yeah, exactly. So these ideas of the third world, of anti-history and anti-culture, and of death works are all concepts from Philip Brief that Carl Truman says, we need these concepts. They're going to help us make sense of the path that we're on. So again, this is the part of his book where he's saying, hey, let me put some tools in your toolbox. Here's some thoughts from Philip Brief. First world, second world, third world, anti-culture, anti-history, and death works. And he's going to come back to these throughout the book and say, do you see how these things are reflected? It's really fascinating as he builds out his sort of the journey he's taking us on. And it's a little bit, the work he's doing here is similar to kind of what Francis Schaeffer used to do well in the 1970s and 80s, where he's sort of charting for you a trajectory of Western culture and saying, hey, let me show you where we've come from and how we've gotten to where we are. But he uses these tools from Philip Brief as a means throughout the book of coming back and saying, okay, do you remember when we talked about an anti-culture? Do you see how this, for instance, transgender ideology creates an anti-culture because it obliterates and destroys any meaningful conversation about the givenness of sexuality and gender? So he's going to come back to this over and over again. But I think these concepts are helpful for Christians to go back to what I was saying a few minutes ago. It's clear to me that we must take seriously our responsibility for shaping a counterculture and for churches to have a rich and robust culture within them. In other words, a church is more than a dispenser of gospel ministry or a vendor of religious goods and services or a place where people come to gather for worship. A church must be a place of rich and robust cultural deposit. It needs to give people real meaningful connection to history and tradition and thought and life and art and aesthetic and beauty because we no longer live in a culture that's giving that to us. We live in a culture, in fact, that disdains most of that and thinks that it's all unworthy of really paying attention to. And so it's going to be more and more important going forward for the church to be a place where people really feel immersed in something that really feels meaningful and rich and full.
Is it fair to say in what Truman is describing here and the philosophers he's pulling off of that within a third world, the conflict doesn't even require the presence of those who believe maybe have a first world or second world framework. Let's say you pulled all the Christians, all the people who followed myth, whatever transcendent view out of our current culture, you'd still have the third world, like people who adopt the same mindset, just eating.
Yes.
Like they're just, it'd still be a battle.
Which is exactly what Nietzsche foresaw, which is why he's such a brilliant philosopher. He said, hey, once you take God out of the picture, you don't have any grounds to adjudicate moral differences. And so really all you have is will to power. You just have you just have various subgroups, various identity groups who are fighting for power so that they can instantiate their vision of morality and what's good.
Yeah, and you see this taking place when you look at the various identity groups, identity politics you have, whether it be LGBTQ, racial minorities, feminism, like
Trump, Christian nationalists.
Yeah.
I mean, pick a group, right?
When you see feminists and LGBTQ and anti-racists fighting,
yes,
and they probably all have the same worldview framework, whatever, you see this sort of the death works, anti-culture at work. And so my point here is the conflict doesn't require the worlds colliding. Like just the third world by nature is going to do this. It's going to be destructive. It also, this thought into your point, which you were making a few minutes ago, Bob, of the church being this place where culture is created. I love that idea. But there's also this ginormous skepticism I have about evangelicals doing that well.
Okay, well, don't think about it as culture being created. Just start with passing on our Christian heritage and tradition, like the culture we already have to hand on.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
I'm with you that we may not want you know, another round of CCM.
Yeah. Like what? Right. So, okay. So yeah, frame it your way to pass on. What are we passing on?
Well, I'm just suggesting that, like, think about how, for instance, it used to be the case that we understood, we being Western culture, American culture, understood the heritage of like Western European art, a lot of which was the church's art, mm-hmm. right? So think about the Sistine Chapel, right? That's a chapel. It's a church building. But we saw the creation of Adam and these amazing paintings as part of our cultural heritage that we needed to pass on. Now we live in a culture that sees that as the work of a bunch of white European patriarchs who need to be, it needs to all be jettisoned, right? Well, that heritage still belongs to the church. We can still introduce our people to it as, hey, this is sacred art. This is part mm-hmm. of the church's heritage of expressing faith in God and expressing the beauty of life in the world and expressing the goodness of being made in the image of God. So I'm just saying, like, the church has a carrying on and a passing on of this needs to be part of our, we need to do more than just teach the Bible. Is to say it another way. We need to also pass on a very robust view of human life and mm-hmm. of the world and introduce people to the best art, poetry, beauty, you know, the beautiful things the church has created over 2,000 years in our people, the people of God need to understand that's all important.
Yeah.
And it's not going to be mass produced. We got to, like, it's not going to be CCM right. that we're passing. It's going to be, you know, the Andrew Petersons and the Jill Phillips of the world right. that were, you know, cultivating those kind of artists and that kind of art, that's what the stuff we want to hand down.
Yeah, he uses the example of the Reformation as an example of like the Second World sort of adjudicating between, hey, what's the best version yeah. of our beliefs? And that example is intriguing to me because you think of like the magisterial reformers who wanted to hold on to a lot of tradition, connected the church and state in some significant ways, and maybe ways that we would even feel uncomfortable as Americans. But there was this robust, holistic view of culture within like the church and influence. Yes. And that in some ways feels like a somewhat different than American church relationship to culture. In some ways there's carryover, but there's some ways there's different. So I don't know what exactly my point is here. I'm just more highlighting that within what we're talking about, there are some different versions of this and different maybe visions of this.
Yes.
And so I think it's perhaps for the church to do this well, we need to seriously ask ourselves, what is the vision that we're after? What is it that we're trying to recapture and pass down? And are we going to do this? I mean, for my part, I would much rather the version of the magisterial reformers than the radical reformation and some of the fruit of that. But, and I would even say for my own part too, of, I have a lot of cynicism about when the church does this sometimes of just what we produce.
And the church does what?
Chris? Well, tries to grab the reins of cultural control and cultural power. And so you get some really stuff.
I'm not suggesting we should do that.
No, I'm...
Your cynicism
what are you so cynical about, Chris?
Death but, work to me.
But here's the thing, though, is I don't know how you avoid that. Maybe this is a future podcast, but I don't know. I'm not saying that's exactly what you're saying. But I don't think we can so neatly parse one and the other, because to some degree, culture includes power.
And so
the... How we do this well, do we need to be grabbing for cultural power? No, I'm not saying that. But so often those that are given to versions of what you're describing, Bob, include that. And so I'm just expressing when I hear this, there's a part of me that goes, man, I love this. I want this. Yes, amen. But there's a cynical side of me that says, but there are ways we try to do this that get kind of weird.
Well, don't be such a cynic, man.
Yeah, it's hard.
Bob, would you say that instead of, you know, like for years we've said that the church must engage culture. After reading this, would you say the church must preserve the culture we have?
I think preserve might be a better word.
And then how do we do that without fear as the motivator?
Yeah, I don't know. I mean, I think we have a positive and constructive vision rather than a negative and protective vision.
Yeah.
So to go back to something you said a minute ago, Chris, this is a way broad generalization, but here's an example of what I'm thinking about right now. It doesn't seem likely to me that the modern liberal arts university is going to remain a place that passes on much culture. It seems like it's going in the direction of becoming a place that's, you know, free speech isn't even allowed. And it's kind of exists to pass on a certain vision of the self.
Yeah.
And to give people a place to perform their view of, you know, progressivism. So it seems to me somebody's going to have to step in and fill that gap.
Mm. Yeah.
And maybe that's Christian colleges and universities. Maybe that's other, you know, other entities, other institutions that get created in the future. But I don't want to just say, the church can't just sit back and say, well, you know what, if modern universities don't pass on any heritage or connection to history, that's no big deal. It actually is a big deal because our kids are going to need a place to go to college. You see what I'm saying? Mm-hmm. Like all of us who care about the future, need to be, have a vested connection to, hey, if we're living in a third world, anti-culture, death works, anti-historical kind of moment, what might the Lord be calling some of us to build alternative institutions that actually will do some of that work? So I'm getting to the thing, I think the thing you're feeling, I'm not saying let's go write some more CCM and, you know, start a Christian publishing ministry. I'm saying more, how does the church need to be and how do Christians need to be more innovative, more visionary, and more proactive here to maybe think about our calling and our role in passing on culture and history, because this is where we need, and you know, maybe that looks like running for office and changing the future. I don't know, but it's I'm skeptical that politics is a place to do that anymore.
Yeah.
You know,
when you guys say the church doing this, are you saying churches like Coram Deo and First City, or are you saying Christians, the church?
I think I'm saying both. Chris got me confused. Chris started getting,
I'm getting
cynical.
No, I'm tracking. All I'm saying is, and maybe this is just me being thinking about this maybe overly idealistic of like, I'm completely tracking and agree. Just knowing that how we are in, especially in America, the church in America, is that this is done in very different ways. If you want, you know, this is a very overgeneralized way to put it, but you kind of high church, low church ways of doing this.
I know we have a lot of listeners, but the good news is not all of America is listening to our podcast.
That's true.
So I'm trying really talking for our listeners.
If you're not in the United States, hey,
you're probably doing better than us anyway. Yeah, you're probably not living in a third world anti-culture.
Yeah, but I mean, you even to your example of like the Christian university, you know that they're not all created equal, right?
Exactly.
Yeah. And not to say that we have to, you know, find this way to like do it all the same, but I guess this vision, like, hey, let's think well, let's do a good job of maybe recognizing ways that we do this that haven't worked and maybe aren't helpful. Because I do think, to your point, Bob, creating institutions is going to be huge.
Yeah.
It really is going to be.
Well, important. And look, this is, I'm also calling the church leaders that are listening, church members that are listening, to say the church has to care about more than just making disciples.
Mm.
Or the church has to see, as part of making disciples, passing on a heritage.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Because I think, I guess what I'm saying, Chris, is if I think back to use Truman's example, right? Think back to our grandparents' generation. Okay. My grandfather lived in a world where the cultural heritage he needed to be passed on to his kids was going to be passed on through the educational system and through the town that he lived in and through the institutions of liberal society. And he could just make disciples. We don't live in that world anymore.
Yeah.
We increasingly live in a world where none of that's getting passed on. And so I'm just suggesting, I want the church to care about human flourishing and passing on a vision of what it means to be connected to the human history that we're a part of. You know, that needs to be part of how the church conceives its mission. And to the extent that we just can start heading in that direction, start thinking about those things, I think that's a win for this podcast, is just for people to start thinking, okay, how do we, what might that look like?
Yeah.
You know, we're sitting here in a room with a few thousand volumes that I purchased from the Grace University Library. Why? For this reason. Mm. Because there was a university that was an institution in our city that preserved a certain kind of theological education and learning. And when that institution went away, I didn't want to lose all the artifacts that provided that. And so I said, can I buy a bunch of the library so that we can preserve it at Coram Deo? And so that hopefully decades from now, when people are looking for a good book that was written in 1970 on the Book of Romans, there's one over here on the shelf. You know, like, we're just trying to preserve some cultural elements, because I don't imagine that the broader culture ever cares what happened to the Theological Library of Grace University. I just don't think that's, no one's caring about that except people that care about that kind of cultural artifact, right?
Yeah.
So that's an example of kind of the thing I think I'm talking about.
So part of making disciples is also caring about my spiritual heritage.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. And whatever, you know, points of disagreement with Dreyer and Benedict option, I think his analogy in a lot of ways is on point of, you know, those little monastic communities that were preserving a heritage that popped up after Rome collapsed. You kind of see where are those institutions, where are going to be those places that are trying to preserve a heritage and tradition. And then the fruitfulness on the other side of that, when, you know, Europe was basically rebuilt. And so I think that framework, you know, however you want to get into the details about how it works itself out, I think that framework is super helpful. Like, we're seeing a collapse of a culture, a collapse of a tradition. Where is that going to be preserved and held onto and passed down? Because, you know, no matter whatever view of history you take, movements, they come and go, you know, and things will run out of steam, and there'll be a place for rebuilding at some point.
Yep. Let's wrap up this 47-minute podcast, Mike. Land this
more point. To come from Truman for sure. I can tell
more to come from Carl Truman's book, The Rise and Triumph of the Modern Self. If you're looking for a good book to start the new year, I recommend it. It's 400 pages or so. And you know, it's not a hard read, but it's a read that's, you know, it's going to engage you.
Yeah. You got to think a little bit.
You have to engage your mind, but
the cover's cool
and a really, really helpful book.
The goal of this podcast is to equip our own church for discipleship and mission. So if you're a Christian or church leader in another context, we thank you for listening in, and we pray that this conversation might be helpful to you as you minister in your own context. We always love to hear from you, the listeners. So send us an email, podcast@cdomaha.com, and we'll see you again next Wednesday in the new year for another Wednesday conversation.